16, present at the table is Co-Chair Parnell, Senator Donnelly, Senator Lehman, Senator Wilkins, Senator Green, Senator Kelly, Senator Adams, and myself, Senator Torgerson. The first bill up today will be Senate Bill 298. This is an act relating to the compensation of certain public employees and officials not covered by collective bargaining agreements and providing for an effective date. Is there someone from the administration to present the bill? This is a bill introduced by Senate Rules by request of the governor. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Allison Elgee, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Senate Bill 298 was introduced to provide to the non-covered employees of the executive branch, the legislature, and the judicial branch similar increases to those that we have collectively bargained in the contracts that are presently before you. This piece of legislation includes in year one a lump sum benefit of $1,200 payable on a $50 per pay period basis to employees that were actually employed in the year prior to July 1 of 2000 for each pay period that they were employed. In year two, which would be effective July 1 of 2001, it includes an increase of 2%, and in year three, an increase of 3% to the salary schedule for these employees. I've provided a sectional analysis to the bill as it's introduced that I believe is in your packet. If people have questions, I'd be happy to respond to them.
Questions? Senator Adams.
We do have a UCS before us. Mm-hmm. Have you looked at it? Is that the same, or what changes are made to your presentation?
Through the chair, I just received a copy of the CS and have only had a chance to look at it briefly. It appears to me that there are a couple of substantive changes. It proposes in year three the amendment to the salary schedule at 2% instead of 3%. It proposes a lump sum benefit payment of $800 instead of $1,200. And it appears to limit the employer contribution to health insurance in year three to $600 from our proposal of $630. There may be other changes in this as well. I just have not had a chance to look at it with enough depth.
Other questions? Senator Lehman. On the bill. We have got a CS before us.
On the bill?
On the bill.
Well, I better find the bill to see if this part's going to happen. Section 1, that's in the CS, so I'll wait.
Senator Parnell.
Allison, the extent, the bill that was introduced by the governor just before us at Section 8, page 4, would give that lump sum payment of $800, I presume. It gives it to legislators, it gives it to the governor, it gives it to lieutenant governor. Are the governor, the legislators, and the lieutenant governor included in the other increases here besides the lump sum payment? In other words, under your bill, does the legislators and the governor, lieutenant governor, get the increases for health benefits and for health benefits?
Through the chair, Senator Parnell, health benefits are set for all members of the select benefits plan by the commissioner and include everybody that participates, and that does include legislators, the governor, and the lieutenant governor. In terms of pay increases, there has to be a specific statutory change to address those individuals. And Senate Bill 298, as it was introduced, did address the pay sections for legislators, governor, and lieutenant governor in the future years and applied the same 2% and 3% increase to those.
Okay, and was it when did it take effect? When did the pay raises take effect for the legislators and the governor and lieutenant governor?
Through the chair, the first pay raise is July 1, 2001, and that is the 2%. And the second is July 1, 2002, at 3%.
So you're not counting a lump sum payment as a pay raise to the governor and legislators, but that takes effect 2000, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Other questions?
That's why I like to see it.
We have two people on teleconference that I'd like to get their testimony on the record. They're both in Fairbanks. Paul Lyle.
Well, We don't have the committee substitute that's before you, so it's difficult to give any testimony on it. I don't have any objections with what I've heard in terms of the changes personally, but I don't know what other changes are made by the committee substitute, so it's kind of difficult to testify. Could someone give me, I know it's not my place to ask questions at these hearings, but could someone give me a rundown of what changes are in the committee substitute?
The CS will be in fact to all the LIOs right now. Senator Parnell.
And the committee substitute is not before us at this point in time. It's the original bill. So
we haven't adopted the committee substitute. What did you say? Okay. John Athens, also in Fairbanks?
Well, yes, I am. Thank you. Am I clear that the committee substitute then is not being considered by the Senate Finance Committee at this hearing?
It hasn't been adopted by the Finance Committee yet.
If it is adopted, would we have a chance to be to see it and be heard on it?
It's being faxed to you right now.
Okay. Well, I would like to hear my testimony and so I have a chance to review it.
All right.
Thank you.
Back in general, Don, AFL-CIO.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Etheridge, lobbyist for the AFL-CIO, here to testify in favor of the bill. We believe that all public employees deserve to make a fair living, and this is a opportunity for the non-covers as well to get the increases as well as the others that are being considered.
That's not what I'm saying.
To contact. And I testified in House State Affairs also that I believe the legislature should also be getting the increase, but they cut themselves out of it. And my testimony on that was the fact that it's hard for anybody to even consider the office unless you've got some other type of income to supplement your state pay, because you just can't live on the wages that you folks make. And we support the current version of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, Don, for joining us. Okay, next, I'd like to invite Senator Kelly up to the table to tell us what's in the proposed CS.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just in case there wasn't support in the legislature to fund the monetary terms of the 12 contracts in front of us, I was asked by the leadership to develop a counterproposal along the terms of the amount of money that this legislature may or may not be prepared to support. I can only speak for myself on this proposed committee substitute. I don't pretend to speak for any particular group or any particular majority. The rules, the proposed committee substitute in front of you makes about five changes. The first one is it rolls the governor's bill, Senate Bill 282, which raises the salaries of department heads into the bill but has an effective date of January 2003. So that would take care of department heads for the next administration. Hopefully that will help to attract good, strong, capable people in the next administration. It does three things in terms of the monetary terms as proposed by the governor. It lowers the signing bonus from $1,200 to $800. It lowers the raise in the third year from 3% to 2%, and it caps the health care benefit in the third year from, it lowers it from $630 to $600. Those are the three significant things it does. And it does not include the legislature or the legislators or the governor and lieutenant governor in the lump sum. To my knowledge, it includes everybody else in the executive and judicial branches and legislative branches other than elected legislators, the elected governor and lieutenant governor. Although the lieutenant governor, the governor, and legislators do receive the health care benefit if that's adopted. It has an effective date of July 1 of this year or when the monetary terms of a majority of the 12 collective bargaining agreements have been adopted by the legislature in a regular or special session. So the uncovered employees would not receive this raise until a majority of the union contracts were appropriated by the legislature.
And the last effective date, this Section 12 covers the
department heads.
Department heads.
Submitted by the governor. Actually, that effective date is different than the bill the governor introduced. He wanted an immediate effective date. I felt it'd be more acceptable to the legislature as a whole if it were prospective for the next administration.
Questions, Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, you do have a cost analysis that Legislative Finance did that indicates that there'd be a savings in the first year from the governor's bill of $1.8 million and $2.8 million savings over the three-year course of the bill. There's a great deal of concern, I think, in the legislature that the total cost of the 12 negotiated agreements is about $105 million over the three-year period. And, of course, a great deal of that money will directly increase the fiscal gap that we've been trying to chip away at down here.
Senator Kelly, just I believe that the savings in the first year is $686,000. And the total cumulative for all years, if I'm reading this right, is $1.8 million in the first column. Is that correct, or am I reading that wrong? Looks like they broke it down year one, year two, and the insurance.
You might be correct, Mr. Chairman. You read these things a little quicker than I do.
And the total of cumulative savings is correct at 2.782 over a three-year period. Other questions of Senator Kelly? Senator Adams.
Yes. You stated that with the CS, it changes from 1,200 to 800 with the bonus and 3 to 2 in the third year. Health benefits 630 to 600. How does this play with the other contract that's presently, the other 12 contracts? Are there going to be a separate number than what we presently have, or what's the plan?
In general, the 12 contracts all call for a $1,200 signing bonus. They all call for at least $515 health benefit in the first year. Some of them are getting more than that now. And they all jump to a $575 health benefit in the second year. Some of them will be getting a little bit more than that. And they all the 12 contracts then max out $630 a month health benefit payment in the third year. And they also all call for a 2% increase in the second year, a 3% increase in the third year. So the differences are 1,200 to 800, 630 to 600 a month, and 3% to 2% in the third year.
So, Mr. Chairman, sure. That's my understanding. The other 12 contracts will stay the same. The only changes we'll have in the court system, legislative and executive branch, is that correct?
That is what the legislation says, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Parnell.
Senator Kelly, what's the...
The legislation does not address the 12 contracts that are before the legislature.
That's correct. Senator Kelly, what's the effect of Section 11?
That indicates that this legislation, which in essence is a pay raise for non-union state employees, is not going to affect until a majority of the union contracts have been approved.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Mr. Connell, you want to move the working drafts?
Chairman, I would move CS for Senate Bill number 298, version H, Lauda backdated 42500 as our working vehicle today.
Mr. Jones, we have an Eddie's.
Objection.
There is objection, and we will take a short Eddie's.
What do you object?
Come back to order.
Yes.
We have a motion to adopt GS2081H, Lauda backdated 42500 for, as a committee substitute, Senate Bill 298. There was objection. Is there discussion on the motion to adopt the CS? Senator Adams.
My objection is, even though that this treats courts, legislative, and executive branches, it treats these employees differently. Why shouldn't they say a secretary in Department of Natural Resources get the same provisions as they would as the original bill than this bill if they were in court system, courts versus DNR, a secretary and those. One gets 1,200 signing bonus, one gets 800. You know, there's a difference there in how we treat employees, and that's where I'm coming from, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kelly? Mr. Chairman, if I could answer that. If, in fact, the 12 negotiated contracts are approved by the legislature, I would hope that we would revert this bill back to the governor's position, the $1,200, 2%, 3%. But as of right now, I'm under the impression the support is not there in the legislature for the negotiated contracts. And if that's the case, I think that this is a proposal that can be placed in front of the unions that they might want to look at, and if they're serious about avoiding a public employee strike like I am. I do not want to see a public employee strike in this state. I think it would be very, very counterproductive for not only the state of Alaska, but the public employees themselves.
Senator Adams. We're ahead of our time on this one, Mr. Chairman. Why don't we put the present 12 contracts on the floor of the House and the Senate and vote up or down on them? And then if they're down, then we have something to look at, 298, the committee substitute. Let's make our positions known on this one.
One piece at a time.
Yes.
So thank you for your comments. Other discussion? There is objection. Roll call, please.
Senator Donnelly?
Yes.
Senator Lehman?
Yes.
Senator Adams?
No.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Kelly?
Yes.
Senator Green?
Yes.
Senator Phillips?
Yes.
Senator Parnell?
Yes.
Yes. 8-1
So by 8-1 vote, the committee substitute has been adopted. We're going to set this bill aside for right now, and we will bring it up at a later date. Next, we will go to House Bill. House Bill 419, I won't read the title, but it's a mile long. It's an act relating to the weekly rate of compensation, the minimum and maximum compensation rate for workman's compensation. Paul Grossi is here again. Come up and work us through some questions here.
Mr. Chairman.
We're dealing with the N version,
thank
yes.
You.
Pardon me? N version?
N version,
thank
Senator
you.
Adams, yes. Paul, to start us out with a broad-based question, what is the impact of this on private employers in the state?
Well, the impact of, financially is it would increase the premium rate between 7.7 to 8.9%.
Which is
those numbers I did get from NCCI, which is the rating organization, the national rating organization for insurance, workers' compensation insurance.
So what is that in terms of dollars?
It's probably... That one's difficult for me to say, but it's probably between $10 and $15 million a year overall.
Additional,
perhaps more.
An additional tax, is that what this would be?
In addition to tax.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand that question.
Oh, I see. Senator Donnelly?
Mr. Chairman. He didn't understand what you just said. I don't think he heard you correctly. You might want to repeat it.
It's part of the rate. That increase, Mr. Rowley,
yeah,
said
that would be
part of the rate.
That's
the
not in addition to tax.
That's
a tax.
It's a premium tax?
No, that wouldn't be an addition to that. No. Senator, I'm sorry. I just didn't understand your question.
Senator Donnelly, you have a remark?
Oh, I just wanted to clarify that, Mr. Chairman. Is that correct, Mr. Rowland?
That is correct.
And I think it's also important to note that rates have dropped something like 43% over the past 12 years.
The premium rate, the overall premium rate has gone down over 40%. Since the 1988 amendments or the reforms for the place.
Senator Green.
Mr. Chairman, I think I may have a question to follow up on your question. If the rate of the premium goes up, does the premium tax go up?
The The premium tax rate is set at 2.7%, so if the overall premium goes up, there would be some additional funds in there. That's the question.
So the premium tax does go up when the rate of the premium goes up? Yes and no.
So
2.7 of 10.
On page, top of page 9. Subparagraph Q. What are we doing there when we say that? Well, what's paragraph Q doing?
Q.
That's a that actually is a amendment that was added in Judiciary, and I believe that was Senator Donnelly's amendment. But basically, it just says that. The check would be can be cashed on a federal or state institution. It's an assurance that the payment would be the check would be able to be cashed.
I don't understand what we're trying to get to there. Are we issuing checks that aren't drawn on federal financial institutions?
Mr. Chairman, this is my amendment.
Senator Donner.
During the 88 rewrite, which was the last major rewrite of workers' compensation, there was a lot of testimony that some unscrupulous insurers were paying benefits to workers on checks drawn on Bahamian banks. It would take like 2 to 3 months for the workers to be able to cash the check. The division's been trying to address that through regulation and other policies. This section just makes it clear that the negotiable instruments need to be negotiable, need to be drawn on American banks that the workers can cash in a timely manner.
Okay. The next subsection, 15, we have historically used a set amount of money, and you're using a floating rate on this. Have you cost analyzed this out past this year?
The rate was established just on the first year, as far as the premium, the effective premium. No, I haven't. This actually is an index. It might have a small effect on premium over the years, but that change in average wage has been last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years at approximately 2% or less.
So what would the rate go to under this, from $700 to what today?
$772, I believe. This does, Senator, for the record, this does address one of the audit's concerns about benefits, in that they felt that the benefit should be indexed, and I'd have to get the exact page, but they felt that the benefit should be indexed, especially the maximum rate. They said CPI. This was indexed at the Alaska average weekly wage, which is a more accurate reflection of the change of wages rather than overall cost of product.
And if I go back to page 4, line 17, is that tied into that section where I'm reading that it's 70% of the employee spendable, but not to exceed 105%, so that's the minimum maximum. Does that apply back to this?
Yes, it does.
And what's the 105%? What makes me believe that if there could be a range at all, it would just be always at the 105%?
Basically, the 105%, the way the law is currently, the maximum for workers' compensation weekly benefits is set at $700, but for retraining benefits, it's at $750, I believe is the. And so what this was the same ratio.
Okay, but this only applies to the reemployment plan,
right?
The retraining plan.
Yes.
Okay.
America's experiment.
Okay. Is there? Are benefits included into the average work, the on Section 15, does that include benefits, or is that just the salaries?
No, that is basically, that calculation is all the wages divided by all the jobs, and it's just the average of that.
So the answer is no benefits.
I think there are certain wages and fringes that are calculated into that.
Do we have an idea what those are?
Can I get back to you with that? I don't have those with me right now. That is something that research and analysis does calculate, though, in our department.
Okay. Well, I'll need to know that. Just so we're clear as to what we are adding into that. Are there other questions? Senator Green.
In the process of doing this, you've changed from listing items by a specific amount and going to some other kind of index, which I think the audit recommended. And is there not a reason to do that in Section 5 or in there's another area, in Section 17?
Let's see, Section 5.
13,300.
Section 5 is not really based on wages. It's based on the cost of education, or that's what it's for. It's for retraining purposes. The audit does suggest that we do that. The people that were working on this particular bill didn't have the benefit of the audit, though, and we really weren't allowed to release it until March. So we couldn't. We did have it in January, but we weren't committed to release it to the public until it became public in March.
Mr. Chairman, is there not a formula that would be more appropriate to put in to statute rather than figures based on the maximum, 13,300 and 170, and then on down in Section 18? Now, that's funeral expenses, but that's rather than come back in 7 years or 6 years and say, oh, we really made a mistake in 2000 when we passed this and we put specific amounts in there. That's all I was getting at.
Kelly and then Senator Parnell.
Mr. Chairman, my question, I answered my question.
Okay, thank you. Senator Parnell.
I'm looking at Section 13, and that has to do with the amending a section having to do with suspending the running of the two-year time period as part of the claim procedure. What is happening there, and why are we doing that? It just appears that if they can go through the whole process, request the hearing, get it noticed, and they can request one continuance now and string it out for another 2 years under the amendment in the bill at page 8. And I guess my question is, why would we want to be doing that?
There's a Supreme Court case that basically said that the statute is presently in the law, but it was interpreted by the Supreme Court as stating that. Let me just back up just a moment. The purpose of this case is a sort of failure to prosecute, and so it's to move the case along. That's the intention. The Supreme Court interpreted that though that if there was a request any time, then that told the statute forever. So basically what this is doing is saying that if a continuance is granted or there's there's a cancellation of a hearing, then the 2 years 2 years starts to count again.
Okay, so the Supreme Court said that if a hearing request is made, that holds the statute of limitation or a continuance?
Forever, yeah.
Forever. Okay, what case is that?
Tipton.
That ought to be enough to find it.
I believe I have that on our package.
So what we're doing here is putting back on a time period.
Yes.
I guess how long does it take nowadays for the average work comp claim controverted to make it through your system?
It varies, but it can be a very long time. Right now they're stating that if a request for hearing happens, it's going to be close to 6 months to get a hearing.
Okay, but that's after they've gone through discovery.
Yes, that's after discovery.
Okay, my concern here is that we're, and I agree, it's helpful to have a time period. If the Supreme Court says that that holds the running of the two-year time frame forever, but my concern is that it could already be stretched out by a couple of years, and then it can get stretched out by another 2 years by the simple moving for a continuance. And I'll take a look at the case.
I would, Senator Parnell, through the chair, the continuances are not just, I mean, they have to have cause for a continuance, and those, you know, those are somewhat outlined in the regs. So, you just can't say, I want a continuance.
Well, just about, I mean,
maybe
the work comp system is different than the court system, but continuances are granted in the court system almost as a matter of course at least one time. And I don't know if the work comp system is any different than that, but this can really stretch the time frame for resolution out, which is not really fair to employees or employers. And I'm just trying to figure out how.
Yeah. And I think that was what they were trying to address.
Okay.
Is the short answer to that is that was the problem.
Okay. Thank you.
Houston versus Soho. Okay. Other questions? There are none. Thank you. We do have our auditor here today. Pat Davidson, to talk about the audit and to answer questions that the folks might have. So, Pat, you want to join us, please? Senator Phil.
Can I just preface?
Sure. Go ahead.
So, I'm setting it up right now. Mr. Chairman, we have a legislative audit that was released a couple of months ago, and I have two amendments that would be addressed by this body for that are not addressed in this bill. It would be the recommendation number 4.
Page 46.
Oh, you have the audit? Okay, page 46. It'll be number 3. Page 47. Recommendation number 5. And I have two amendments for these two recommendations that are not currently in the bill. And I have Pat Davidson to explain the details.
Pat, I'd rather wait till we get the amendments before, but I just had a couple of questions on some of the comments earlier. I've read the audit, but just for the record, we suggest that we index the price, the weekly price, instead of a flat rate. Is that part of the audit recommendations?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Pat Davidson. In the audit, what we saw was a deterioration of the flat amount set in statute, and the audit recommends that they be increased to something reflecting the more current purchasing power of those values. It's really up to the legislature whether they would like to periodically update those or establish in statute a mechanism that automatically allows for some indexing. It's totally up to the legislature how they would like to do that.
Well, that's the way I remember when I read the audit, but the testimony was that it was a suggestion that we index, and I didn't think that you suggested that we index.
Through the chair, Senator Torgerson, I don't believe we did suggest that, though it may have been in some discussion.
Thank you. You can just stay there. We do have two other amendments before Senator Phillips, so we might as well just deal with those, and then we'll get right to that one also. The first amendment, amendment number 1, is by Senator Donnelly. Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, currently the way the death benefit works for widows or surviving widowers or surviving children is that other than covering up to $2,500 worth of funeral expenses, the benefit is based on a weekly benefit that's paid for 10 years. And this amendment would change that so that benefit would be paid for 12 years. There's only about 20 to 30 Alaskan families a year suffer a loss of a worker on the job. I think this would be a de minimis effect on any rates, but I think it would be significant to those families that did lose somebody on the job and help them make it through that time period for a little bit longer. So what this amendment does is change the current 10-year rule to 12 years, and I do recommend number 1.
Amendment number one has been moved.
I'm going to object just for question.
There's an objection, Senator Adams.
Yes, I think I'll support the amendment. My question is why don't you keep the 20 years in versus 12 because of the fact that life expectancy is much higher nowadays? And that's my question. Why?
Chairman, the 10-year that's in existing statute was a totally arbitrary number. I just wanted to make an incremental increase. We should be making progress, as you say, Senator Adams, because people are living longer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Green, did you have a comment?
This refers to employees killed on the job.
Right.
I just want to be sure of that.
Pardon me, Senator Green.
No, I'll think about it.
Other discussion on amendment number one. Is there objection to amendment number one? Hearing none, amendment number one has been adopted by the committee. Brings us to amendment number two. Senator Donovan.
Mr. Chairman, amendment number two would add a lump sum benefit for families who suffer the death of a worker. Currently, as I explained earlier, the only benefit is up to $2,500 in funeral expenses. Those specifically have to be for funeral expenses. And although there's maybe some insurance companies just give people a check, but with state workers, it's actually handled by my understanding is it's handled by the risk management folks. They actually write a check directly to the funeral parlor, so it doesn't go to the family. So the only payment that the family does get is the weekly benefit amount. And I would suggest that when you have a working person in a family, a mother or father, that dies on the job, and once again, there's only about 20 or 30 of these families in Alaska a year, there are some very, very big costs to that family in legal fees and just reorganizing your family structure to deal with that kind of a loss. All the things that go with that that are above and beyond any funeral costs. And I think it'd be, once again, a very small amount of money. Okay, we're talking about only about 30 or no more than 30 times a year this would be paid to the family. And what my amendment suggests is that we should give those families a lump payment in addition to what they currently get, which is zero as far as a lump payment. But for the first time, give the families of killed workers a $5,000 payment to help get over some of those expenses. So I'd move amendment number two.
There's objection. It has been moved. There's objection. Senator Green and Senator Parnell. Do you have a comment, Senator Green?
Yeah, the wording is substantially different from the current process because I have an idea that amount was intended specifically for funeral expenses and not as part of the death benefits or death settlement. And I assume that there is other insurance coverage that is also at the time to the family.
There is.
And if the argument is $2,500 isn't enough to pay for the funeral, then we're not making any provision that the funeral be paid for by this language.
Sure. I don't think they're interrelated. But Senator Donnelly?
They're not related. This doesn't affect the funeral benefit section. It adds a new section that would just pay $5,000 for... So it's
okay.
Not specifically designated for funeral.
Yeah, we get $5,000 for the funeral benefits and $5,000 as an additional payment.
Right.
Excuse me. I did not see... Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.
Senator Parnell.
I have to say I agree with where Senator Donnelly is going. I'm just not sure we're going about it perhaps in the most appropriate manner, because under the current statute, and this is just as I read it, 2332.15, they get $2,500 for the reasonable and necessary funeral expenses, and which is being raised to $5,000 in the bill. And then they get, if there is a widow or widower or child or children of the deceased, they get 80% of the spendable weekly wage of the deceased for the widow or widower with no children, 50% for the widow or widower with one child, and 40% for the child. I mean, in addition to the funeral benefit, there is a weekly wage benefit that gets paid to the family. And it seems to me that what we would, rather than paying out another lump sum, it seems like we would want to be adjusting further the weekly wage if you're going to go that route, rather than a lump sum. And I don't know what Senator Donnelly's intent is, but I'm just not sure why we would pay a lump sum when we've already got a statutory framework set up for weekly wage and funeral expenses.
Senator Donnelly.
Chairman, The reason I think this is a better public policy is because the worker hadn't died, they'd continue to get 100% of the worker's salary.
Wages, right.
And under the current system, they get a reduced percentage of the wages that continue. Now, that's what that family unit has adjusted to and is living on. These are working people. This isn't a gift. This is something that they've paid, you know, by their wages, you know, through unemployment insurance. I mean, not unemployment insurance, but through, it's part of the total package of work, of the cost of employing somebody. And as it is now, when this death occurs, now we're going to cover the funeral costs, but we don't cover any of the other costs that are going to come from that death. And unless somebody has an independent life insurance policy, or unless their employment provided some sort of special non-statutory life insurance coverage, they don't have anything to pay for the costs that are incurred by the death of that worker. All they're going to get is a reduced amount from what they would have normally got every week from that person's employment. I really do think that when families suffer this kind of a catastrophic loss, there are a lot of immediate costs that occur to those families that currently we don't make any allowance for in workers' compensation statutes. And I think $5,000 is a real reasonable amount. We talk to spread it out over the, let's go to the maximum. It's between 20 and 30 a year. We're only talking, you know, about 30 times $5,000 for the entire workers' comp system here, which is a huge millions of dollars. We're talking about a de minimis amount as far as actuarially impacting the system. But I would suggest that $5,000 to a family at a moment in time when they've lost one of the working parents who's supporting that family is very significant. And it's a very small amount, but it could be a huge effect upon that family's ability to continue and survive.
I didn't argue it wouldn't be significant. I argued that what they've lost, besides the love and affection of that person, what they've lost is the weekly wage. And what I was trying to get at was whether or not, I think your argument to me about your immediate cost to families, that makes more sense than what I heard you saying before.
Other discussion on amendment number two.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Green.
Is there any way to see if there are any other besides the 150, more or less, maybe annual cost that the adding on does to the cost of the employer's piece of workers' comp and the subsequent, I mean, whether it impacts the rate or is it too small to have any impact? Or if we continue to add on, and then some say we have another amendment that adds on something else, we're getting to a point where we are impacting the rate. And what I hear most from people is their satisfaction with what they're injured and the delays in hearings and settlements and all of that. And we're addressing something that I would assume we should be including in the employee contracts that says, everyone has a life insurance policy of X, and I don't know, it may already be there. And that's part of that package versus a death benefit through workers' comp. Do we not have any insurance for state employees that are part of the employee package?
Of course, this covers a lot more than the state employees, everybody in the state. So I think we do have death benefits.
Okay, so for state employees, it would be okay.
Insurance have death benefits, but this covers everyone in the state. Senator Wilkins.
Senator Donnelly, do you know how many, just a rough number, how many people do we lose on the job this year?
Between 20 and 30 a year. Paul, what was it last year, like 26?
Really? Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Brings back amendment number two before us. Senator Parnell.
I just wanted to disclose I am an employer in my private practice and would be impacted by the bill and any amendments we vote on, so I would ask that I be excused from voting.
Okay.
Conflict will be noted for the record.
Senator Kelly. No, I
don't know. He's unemployed.
The question was, we don't have to make a declaration of conflict.
No, you just have to declare to the conflict. You don't have to ask to be excused
on
from voting.
Okay.
Right. But you do have to notice the conflict, and it's not a question of whether or not you're entitled to vote or not entitled to vote on a committee level. So, Senator Donnelly.
I would agree with Senator Green. The vast amount of the issues around workers' compensation really do deal with rehabilitation of workers and bringing them back, and that's where the big money is. This is a very small amount of money, but I would say that over the last 10 years, I've probably been contacted at least 4 or 5 times by families who have suffered deaths and were shocked when they found out there was nothing other than the $2,500 funeral benefit that came to them immediately to help them get over that. And it, as recently as the Midtown murders in Anchorage, I've heard from people who were really surprised there was no, you know, for the best, you know, for the people who worked in restaurants there. Because when they were killed, they were on the job. And so all those families got was up to $2,500 worth of funeral benefits.
Senator Wilkins brings amendment number 2 back before us. Is there objection to the adoption of amendment number 2?
I'm going to object, Mr. Chairman, because I just don't understand.
Further discussion.
We can do this incrementally.
Roll call, please.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Kelly?
Yes.
Senator Green?
No.
Senator Phillips?
Yes.
Senator Donnelly?
Yes.
Senator Lehman?
Yes.
Senator Adams?
Yes.
Senator Parnell?
Yes.
Senator Torkelson?
Yes.
8 yeas, 1 nay.
So by 8-1 vote, the committee has adopted amendment number 2. That brings us next to amendment number 3. This is what Senator Phillips was discussing. And Pat, thanks for letting us wade through those. So you'll have a roll now, I promise. Senator Phillips.
Chairman, I'm going to have Pat Davidson explain the amendment, but I'll move amendment number 3, and that would show up on, if you look at your audit, it would be recommendation 4, parentheses 3, on page 46.
But we don't have that audit, so
right, well,
you'll probably, well, Pat, you can read the part of the audit that we're referring to here. I will object, at least for discussion purposes. Pat, if you'll go ahead and start us out here again.
Thank you, Sandra. In the audit, we recommended various issues to help workers' comp, the division staff, streamline, try to get more efficient, try to deal with the backlog. One of the things that we saw causing some inefficiencies and reducing the reliability of their information was that either the insurers or the insurers' adjusters on behalf of the employers were not filing notices in a timely manner when the insurance was continued. There is things in statute that if the insurance is discontinued, those insurers or adjusters have a need to notify that they are no longer the insurer for that employer. But there's nothing really to encourage them to report in a timely manner. What we suggested to enhance reporting in a more timely manner was to allow the agency to develop a sanction or impose a fine to encourage these insurers or adjusters to get the information into the division in a more timely manner. That should streamline the investigative efforts of workers' comp staff and allow their computer system to be a little bit more up-to-date and therefore more reliable. And as I read the amendment offered by Senator Phillips, I believe that the language in here would do that. Just reading it real quickly, a question that I would have that maybe the division director could answer is whether that should be that the board should impose the fine or whether that is something that the agency, the division itself, should be able to do. I don't know that in terms of a matter of efficiency, and possibly the director could shed some light on that for you.
Paul. Come shed some light.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Green.
Yeah, I need to declare a conflict.
Okay, your conflict noted for the record. Paul, you need the question repeated, or
yes, I think that this will work fine the way it is. It would be a little simpler if the department could issue the penalty simply because then it would become.
If what now? The penalty what?
The penalty would be issued, but the problem that I see, if it may impose a civil penalty of up to $1,000, that seems to say that there is a range that penalty can be, and I would say that would be a better left to the board to impose, simply because you have a tribunal. It's, you know, there's an industry representative and a a labor representative as well as a agent for the state.
Well, this is what this says. So they may impose. You just can't go over $1,000 a day. You can impose $1 a day.
But what I'm saying is because of that there is a... this seems to indicate that there can be a range up to $1,000 per day. I would say that it would be best left to the board to
set the fee?
Yeah.
Rather than the agency?
Yes.
Senator Green.
Thank you.
Senator Green.
I want to ask a question because I know that, and I don't know if it's the case for workers' comp, but very often a person can have a premium due and not pay the premium on time and have their insurance continue by their relationship with their agent or with whatever. And I don't know what the grace period or time. I think 10 days is very, very short time for an insurer to establish that the person is not going to renew. I mean, if the person calls up and says, I'm canceling my policy, that's one issue. But if a person is maybe perpetually late or a little delayed in getting their premiums in, which is very common, I think the 10-day time limit is very... An insurer may not know that information. They may be reporting a whole bunch of people who are untimely versus people who've canceled coverage. I mean, because you would need a statement of, I'm canceling versus... I'm targeted.
For such existing law, do you have any idea how long this has been in 10 days in the law? Just off of...
I'm sorry, Senator, could you repeat your question?
Do you know how long the 10-day requirement has been in law?
It's been in law since, I believe, the inception of the law, which would have been pre-stated.
No, but it's not applicable to the insurer.
Well, Senator Green, if you want to amend that section, it's certainly open for amendment if you want to go to some other days. But it's in existing law.
Mr. Chairman, it's...
Senator Green.
I would submit it's not in existing law. The 10 days currently applies to the employer, not the employer's insurer. And the insurer may not have any idea that the person is not going to renew. Because of the floating nature of, as I understand, workers' comp coverage. So I don't know what the answer is.
Senator Torgerson, she is correct that that language is new. It was the onus was on the employer in previous law. You know, the insurance company may have the best information on that too, as they know whether the premium was paid. However, they don't. And I don't know of this situation, so I'm not sure. But I would accept that there probably are arrangements out there where an agent may allow some time before they cancel the policy. But the insurance company would have the best information as far as whether or not the premium was paid.
Senator,
I guess I want to know again, what problem are we trying to fix, Pat? Because I don't see the issue here. Can you restate what the problem is?
Certainly. During the course of our audit, we found that either adjusters or insurers were notifying the division in an untimely manner as to whether or not the employer remained insured.
They're not required to under current law to report at all?
They are required to report. However, there is no sanction if they don't report in a timely manner. The 10-day issue is, as I read Alaska Statute 2330.085, there is a 10-day limit to give notice of the termination of an employer's insurance by expiration of cancellation.
Sorry, say it again. Where is the insurer's duty to report expirations and cancellations?
It's
in current law.
Employer, through the chair, Senator Purnell, currently it's the employer's responsibility.
That's right. You just said, though, that they're reporting in an untimely fashion right now. And I'm saying right now they don't even have an obligation to report under this section anyway. Do they have another section they're required to report under? Okay.
Through the chair, Senator Purnell, yes, they do. They are required under 075.
What?
It's under, I'm sorry, for the record, it's Senator Parnell, the chair. It's section 2330, I believe, and it's on, is, this is the subsection 5. See, a termination of a policy by cancellation. Well, that would be by cancellation. So,
I guess what I'm getting at is if there is currently no requirement for insurers to, you know, give notice of every cancellation and termination to the state, then what problem are we trying to fix? And if we're trying to fix this untimely reporting by an insurance company when there is no requirement, that's not a problem I want to fix. The reason... What we're setting up in this amendment is a system where we've got employers with a duty to report and we've got insurance companies with a duty to report, and it's either a duplication of effort or we're fixing a problem that really doesn't exist at this point.
To the Chair, Senator Parnell, currently the people that are doing the reporting, the annual reporting, is usually the adjuster or the insurer on behalf of the employer. The responsibility is the employer's, but it typically is the insurance agency that does it.
Right, and if I'm an employer, I may not like State Farm writing my workers' comp policy, so I terminate and I go with Alaska National. And so State Farm sends in the notice of termination or cancellation. And I guess what I see here is I see insurance companies having to report, and I see employers having to report, and penalties for each if neither one reports. And to me, that's a duplication. And it also is going to create an administrative headache, I think, for businesses who are switching policies when they're already subject to penalties if they don't maintain coverage. So I'm concerned on a couple different fronts. So that's why I was curious if there's a direct requirement that insurance companies report cancellations. And
through the Chair, Senator Parnell, Alaska Statute 2330.0305 states the termination of the policy by cancellation is not effective as the employees of the insured employer is covered by it until 20 days after written notice of the termination has been received by the board.
That doesn't lay it on the insurer. That's still the employer's duty, isn't it?
It is, but again, functionally, it's always the insurer, especially in this case.
Right.
The insurer is the one that wants to notify the board as soon as possible so they are off the hook for insuring those employees if the employer has canceled it.
Okay, so why wouldn't we then want the insurance companies reporting and not the employers? I mean, so you get one set of information there. I don't know. I'm just troubled by setting up a dual system here. But dual penalties, when it's just, to me, it creates more administrative headaches for the division as well as for employers. I thought we were trying to fix some headaches here, but I'm not sure we're going to do it with the amendment.
To the Chairman, Senator Parnell. Also under 2330.085, the employer subject to this chapter shall, unless exempted, shall initially file evidence of compliance with the insurance provisions of this chapter in a board prescribed, in a form prescribed by the board.
Yeah, that's the employer's responsibility.
Right.
Right. And the insurance companies are helping the employers meet that responsibility, but to impose a requirement on the insurance companies is duplicative. I think you do one or the other, but that's... you require either the insurance companies to report, you require employers to report, and I think the public policy here is that employers need to be responsible for maintaining their insurance, getting their insurance, and they're responsible for their choices in switching companies as well. So.
The two recommendations combined, the first one was the filing the notices in a timely manner. The second one went to recommendation number 5, which addressed sanctions for uninsured workers just overall. And what we had been recommending is that 2330.085, that there be some sanctions imposed. It could be that the sanctions should be on the employer for filing in an untimely manner, rather than adding the insurance or adjuster.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
At 2330.085, there's already a provision that if an employer fails, refuses, or neglects to comply with the provision of this section, the employer shall be subject to penalties provided in AS 2330.070 for failure to report accidents. So the employer is already subject to penalties for not maintaining coverage, right?
Through the Chair, Senator Parnell, the statutory reference to 2330.070 doesn't impose a penalty unless a compensable injury has occurred. So if you're just an employer, you are not, nobody filed a claim against you, the state cannot impose any penalties on you until a claim comes in.
So you're saying there's a law that requires employers to maintain insurance coverage, workers' comp insurance coverage, but there's nothing that would impose a penalty without a compensable injury?
Through the Chair, yes, Senator, that is true.
Okay, and so where are we fixing that in Amendment number 3 or 4?
Not getting ahead of myself, I believe that is the motion referenced as number 4.
Okay,
that will
thank you.
Be up before you.
You like this amendment or not?
No, I don't like Amendment number 3.
Further discussion on Amendment number 3. There's objections.
Yes.
Okay, roll call, please.
Senator Kelly?
No.
Senator Green?
No.
Senator Phillips?
Yes.
Senator Donnelly?
Yes.
Senator Lehman?
Yes.
Senator Adams?
No.
Senator Wilkin?
No.
Senator Parnell?
No.
Senator Torkelson?
No.
3-8, 6-8.
So by a 3-6 vote, Amendment number 3 has failed to be adopted by the committee. Very confused me. Amendment number 4, Senator Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move Amendment number 4. Again, if some of you guys do have the audit, it is recommendation number 5, as shown on page 47. I'll let Pat respond on it.
Pat, Amendment number 4.
Yes. Yes,
I believe you touched on it already, but go ahead.
As I read this amendment, I think that it goes towards the statutory construction that prevented the board from issuing sanctions against an uninsured employer without a compensable injury having to occur. And what this does, I believe, as I read the amendment, it is intended to eliminate that and allow the board to impose penalties for uninsured employers prior to a claim being filed.
Senator Parnell and Senator Kelly.
I'm going to object for purpose of discussion because I think it goes beyond what Pat has said. Because the amendment itself says if an employer fails to insure, the board shall require the employer to pay the employee a penalty. So it sounds like we've got a compensable injury here. I mean, it sounds like that's part of an action where there is a compensable injury. And the current statute, as it currently reads, says in 2330.080D, it says, if an employer fails to insure or provide security, the board may issue a stop order prohibiting the use of employee labor by the employer until the employer insures or provides security. It goes on to say that they can stop work at that point. They can issue a stop order, stop working. And if the employer fails to comply with the stop order, the board shall assess a civil penalty of $1,000 per day. The employer may not obtain a public contract with the state or political subdivision of the state for 3 years following the violation of the stop order. So there are penalties for violating a stop order, which occurs if an employer is not insured or fails to insure. And if we're trying to address that situation, I think that's already covered at that point, as I read it. I think the amendment actually addresses the compensable injury situation and doesn't address where there's no injury.
To the Chair, Senator Parnell, I got this amendment about the same time you did, and I been going over it with my red pen, and I'm not sure that the recommendation that we were making is wholly or solely addressed in the language here. I agree with you that it seems to be focused more on compensation to a worker, which would imply that there's been an injury, and what we want to do, what was intended by the recommendation, is that you disconnect the need to have an injury before some sanctions can be imposed for having an uninsured employer.
And what is it about 2330.080D that doesn't take care of your recommendation, where we already have a penalty for, it's basically a penalty for violating a stop order, but I presume that that's issued if there's no insurance at that point.
No penalty.
Down to 2330.085, Section B.
Pat, is there a way we can fix this amendment to get to what you're trying to fix?
I certainly would be happy to work with the Ledge Legal to try to fix it and address.
I'd like to move this bill this morning. So, is this a long-term fix or short-term?
I just need the attorney's time to go over it.
They wouldn't probably take it out easier. Senator Donnelly?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to suggest that this amendment, as it is now, doesn't require the title change that appears in the beginning of it, because it deals with compensation due, and the title of the bill already covers compensation for all the types of compensation that people would receive, because it includes both any kind of death benefit and the weekly benefit.
I think the resolution was if both amendments pass, so you might be right on that. It's just a staple to amendment number four. We'll check with that with legal, too. We'll have to see what we do come up with. Other discussion before we take an at ease and have Pat.
Oh, gotcha.
Mr. Chairman, just to make it precisely right, why don't I just withdraw the amendment for the time being, and then we'll come up with a rewrite of amendment
number four. Offer on floor?
No, here.
Offer and remove the bill today, so I mean, if we can get to it in a short period of time.
No, hopefully we can.
Okay, well, let's try, and let's take an at ease for about 10 minutes and call the drafters and see if we can get to here.
Look at 2330.085.
Senator Lehman, we're going to go ahead and start. We got one person on teleconference, so we'll take him, and hopefully Senator Parnell will join us by then. Okay, let's go back on the record. We do have one person in Anchorage on teleconference. I believe he's still there, Mr. Kevin Doherty.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your providing the opportunity to testify on this bill. I represent the Alaska Laborers, and I have served on the ad hoc committee as co-chair for the labor component of that eight-member panel. We have supported the bill from the beginning. We think it does have appreciable benefits for injured workers and also for the management team throughout Alaska. So without belaboring the point, we do support the bill. I have not had the opportunity to confer with the employer side of the team on the amendments. I have some personal sympathies for many of the amendments that were before you today, but I think in honor of the employer side, I probably shouldn't comment on those. That's the protocol we usually operate on. So I appreciate your work, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty, and thanks for staying with us all morning. And that brings us back to amendment number four. Senator Phillips did say he's going to remove it, but we didn't really have a motion, so it's still before us.
Yes, sir. Chairman, we consulted with Mike Ford, our legal person, and I'm going to make the following suggestion to the amendment to the amendment, and I'll move it. After the word, on line 8, after the word shall, and Pat tracking to make sure we got this wording word for word, may assess a civil penalty of up to $1,000 per day, period, and delete the remaining sentence. So I'll repeat myself again. After the word board, delete the rest of that sentence. Insert, may assess a civil penalty of up to $1,000 per day, period. And I move that amendment to the amendment.
There's a motion to adopt amendment to the amendment number four. All members of the secretary get the amendment.
I'm going to object for
Senator Green, discussion?
I don't understand how this is laid out particularly, but this wouldn't be more appropriate in 2330.085, duty of employer to file?
Pat, you want to join us back up here, please? Senator Parnell, why is that settling
on? I see another penalty up there.
And that distinction, and this is how I would read it, and maybe Pat or the division could comment on it. Under 080, we currently have a penalty for what essentially amounts to failure to comply with a stop work order.
Uh-huh.
What the amendment would do would provide a penalty for failing to insure or provide security. And then what 085 does is if an employer fails to file evidence of compliance, so it's a third penalty that for different violations of law, essentially. I mean, they're all interrelated, but I just see it as they're different. I would be supportive of the amendment depending on what comes out of our testimony here. But
go ahead, Pat.
Mr. Chairman, the intent going back to the audit was to give the board more options to deal with uninsured employers. As Senator Parnell pointed out, under 2330.080D, there already are some penalties if an employer violates a stop order. When talking to the drafter, we suggested using the word may instead of shall to give the board that opportunity to use their discretion depending upon how long it's gone on, if it's a day, if it's 10 days, if it's a year. And it's just intent to be another tool for the board to bring employers into compliance.
Does this satisfy your requirement of the audit with this?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it does.
From the division.
Paul, you want to join us, please? Just if you would tell us what your feeling is for the amendment, favor, opposed, or just general testimony?
Or if it's even needed.
Need it.
Or if it's even
needed. It would allow the board to assess a civil penalty on an uninsured employer currently, right at this time, we can investigate and prosecute, or at least turn it over to the Department of Law for prosecution of a case, and it allows for a $10,000 criminal penalty for uninsured employer. But of course, you're going to have you have to under that. This would allow the board to assess.
Well, you need to speak up a little bit.
Yeah. I'm sorry. This would give the board more authority to penalize a uninsured employer. Whether it should be an 80 or 85, I think that was one of the questions. I would have to give that a little bit of thought here.
Senator Parnell.
My question, Paul, is it necessary where there's already a penalty, a civil penalty of $1,000 per day, for an employer's failure to comply with a stop order?
Well, a stop order, of course, is once you've gone to the board and gone to a hearing and if they found non-compliant, then if they still fail to comply with that order, then a $1,000 penalty would apply. This, and if I'm reading this wrong, would mean that they could assess the penalty for the failure itself for that period of time prior to the stop order.
Senator Parnell.
How would you envision implementing this kind of a provision?
Well, we would still have to investigate, the potential uninsured employers and bring them to the board.
Do you do that currently?
Yes.
And what happens now when you find that employer doesn't have insurance? What happens?
Well, when the board finds them not in compliance, most of them do comply at that point.
But do you give them notice of their non-compliance and require them to have workers' compensation insurance within 10 days or 30 days, or what do you do to
any due process?
What do you do?
Are you talking about after the order?
No. Once you've identified an employer who doesn't have workers' compensation coverage.
Well, what we try to do is preliminarily, as we go through various records, UI records and business records and so on and so forth, to try to find
identify employers that may be out of compliance, and then our investigator writes some letters first, and then at some point investigates them for non-compliance. And so what this would do, I think, is allow, if there's one in compliance, an employer that is not in compliance, found that way, they can assess, the board can assess penalties.
What about the situation where it's
immediately?
What about the situation where you discover in December that an employer had a gap in coverage of about 6 days back in February because their policy was canceled for some reason, and it took the underwriters some days to get another policy up and running? So you've got 6 days or 10 days of non-covered work. I don't want to see this applied retroactively in that kind of a setting, and it gives you discretion, but that's why I asked you how you would implement a section like this.
A penalty could be assessed under the way
that the amendment's drafted.
Yes.
Other discussion on amendment to amendment number 4? Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Roll call, please.
Senator Donnelly?
Yes.
Senator Lynn?
No.
Senator Adams? Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Kelly?
No.
Senator Green?
No.
Senator Phillips?
Yes.
Senator Parnell?
No.
Senator Torkerson?
Yes.
4 yeas, 4 nays.
So by a 4-4 vote, Amendment Number 4 has failed to be adopted by the committee. Brings back before us the amended version of House Bill 419. Discussion. Senator Wilkins.
Chairman, to the department, over the interim, I heard of a lot of from workers' comp, 3 different occasions, and it all revolved around controverted claims. And I was encouraged when this came out, and it talked also about it. But this bill doesn't do anything for controverted claims. At least it doesn't go as far as perhaps we may. So what I would be interested in is a report from the department as to the definition of controverted claims, monitoring them, and then reporting back to the legislature next year as to the number, the status, whatever measurements you can have that will allow the people to understand controverted claims and what we're going to do to tighten up what a lot of, at least the 3 people that called me, seem to be the main problem with workers' comp, and that is the strung out ability of the insurance companies and the doctors to string out the people that in their minds are harmed. So while I support this bill, there's additional work to be done, and we'll talk about that next year.
Thank you, Senator Wilkins. We need to back up. The amendment number 4 is still in front of us. The amendment to amendment number 4 failed, but amendment number 4 is back to court.
Withdraw.
Motion to withdraw amendment number 4. Is there objection? Hearing no objection, amendment number 4 has been withdrawn. Now a discussion on the bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, during the break, I was talking to Brad Thompson of Risk Management, and he clarified something for me that I didn't realize. And on the benefits that are paid to the widow or widower or the children, as I understand it, that's tax-free. So it is a probably more than we would normally think. If we normally look at a figure and think it's going to be taxed and all the deducts are going to come out of it. So the 12-year, the addition to 12 years, does have an impact if we're going to, because if someone is, a widow is receiving benefits at the time of the death and they reach or arrive at the age of 52 before that's over, they're insured for life. There is no limit on the number of years. And if that's the intention, that's fine. But the 10 to 12 does have an implication. You may want to hear from Brad Thompson. I don't know if it's enough to change anyone's mind or have us rework that, but I thought it was an interesting. I did not know that. So,
I'll come back up just so I can get my answer. My question to you earlier was, are benefits, fringe benefits or anything else, included in the compensation rate? And your answer?
Well, I believe the answer to your, you were asking about the Alaska average weekly wage, which was the calculation of the indexing
right.
portion of it.
Yes.
And the answer to that is no. It's strictly on wages, and it reflects the change in wages over from 1 year to the next.
Thank you. Further discussion on House Bill 419. Is there a motion to move the bill? Senator Donnelly.
Senate CS for, the new finance version. CS for House Bill 419 from committee with individual recommendations with any accompanying fiscal.
Motion to move the bill with accompanying fiscal notes. Is there objection? Hearing none, 419 will move to rules. We will stand in recess to the call of the chair.